Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I'm honoured to be invited to address Sussex University and to be invited by Stephen. I'd just like to say Brighton and Sussex have a very special place in my heart. I grew up in Sussex, and my first romantic memories are all related to Brighton, but I won't go into details in this grim subject which we've got to deal with. I have to say I'm a bit horrified by all the details of things Stephen's managed to find out about me. I think the internet is very, very disturbing. But I'm very relieved at all the things he hasn't managed to find out about me, because it would paint a very different picture than the glowing testimonial that he's kindly given me. But the subject is the Privy Council and the death penalty. I have got a text, and I'm going to try to, as it were, gallop through it and summarise some of it and leave out other bits. But just to start with, the first bit, why am I talking about this, the Privy Council and the death penalty? Because obviously to an English audience, it can seem a little bit remote. The death penalty we no longer have in this country, although we did bequeath it to all our former colonies, together with a particular regime, including, of course, death by hanging as the method of execution. But we ourselves no longer impose it, and indeed we're now committed by treaty, by having signed the 13th Protocol of the European Convention, not to reinstate the death penalty here. That, so much for the death penalty. As to the Privy Council, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council may, of course, sit in Westminster, but they're the final court of appeal to very distant countries, and the Privy Council's own domain is now diminishing. Once it was the final court of appeal throughout the world for all our colonies, from India to Newfoundland, and one has decisions from the 18th century onwards in death penalty cases from India and from other colonies. And even with the end of the empire after the Second World War, it continued as a final court of appeal for many of the newly independent Commonwealth countries during the period from 1945 to 1980. But during that period, its overseas jurisdiction shrank as countries successively removed the right of appeal to the Privy Council. And today, it's confined to a few dependencies and to certain independent countries of the Commonwealth Caribbean, which still retain the right of appeal to the Privy Council. But in these Caribbean states, indigent prisoners still have the right to petition the Privy Council in death row cases and to bring constitutional appeals to the Privy Council arising from the threat of execution. Now, if we look at the way the Privy Council has developed in the 60s and 70s, and indeed in the 80s, the Privy Council took a very harsh, hands-off, abstentionist approach in cases like Runyoa, where they said we're not going to interfere with the death penalty imposed on someone for being a participant in an attempted arson in southern Rhodesia. And they said nothing wrong with the mandatory imposition of the death penalty for being a youthful participant in the attempted arson on a dwelling house, not for us to get involved. But some of the and then it changed to a much more interventionist approach in keeping with modern international human rights principles gradually. Some of the judges of the Privy Council themselves regard their continuing role as an uncomfortable anachronism. And of course, it's easy to denounce their appellate role as a last vestige of colonialism. But however remote and anachronistic the whole idea may seem, we are living in a world where basic human rights are regarded as universal. And what I'd suggest is it's what judges do, not who they are or where they sit in judgment, that matters most. So that's my brief apologia for choosing this subject. I'll just give you some further reasons why you should continue to listen. Firstly, of course, it's not academic in the Caribbean what the Privy Council does. Many individuals have been saved from execution by the decisions of the Privy Council over the last two decades, from countries such as Jamaica and Trinidad, Bahamas, Belize, St. Lucia, St. Kitts, Antigua, etc. The availability of an appeal to the Privy Council as the final court of appeal can still today make the difference between life and death for those on death row facing execution. But in recent years, the Privy Council has moved from the hands-off policy of judicial abstention to this more interventionist approach. And just to give us a summary of some of the things it's done, it's outlawed executions after delay in the case of Pratt and Morgan. It's introduced judicial review and natural justice at the mercy stage. That's the stage at which it's decided whether the death penalty should actually be carried out. It's, moreover, more recently struck down the mandatory imposition of the death penalty. They said there's got to be a sentencing hearing. There's got to be some discretion. You can't just say you're convicted of murder, you're sentenced to death, that's it. And finally, they've introduced a new restrictive approach to the imposition of the death penalty in murder cases. So once they'd introduced the notion that there had to be a sentencing hearing, they then had to address the question, well, what are the principles that apply at these sentencing hearings? How do you decide who should live and who should die? And they had to develop principles, and I'll try to come on to those principles at the end of the talk. Now, the effect of those decisions has been to limit execution to a few isolated cases. And the Privy Council has introduced very exacting safeguards for the imposition of the death penalty. The Privy Council has not, of course, prohibited the death penalty. It can't do that because the death penalty is implicitly recognised as a legitimate form of punishment by the founding constitutions of all independent Commonwealth countries, and indeed all constitutions of the Westminster model. The right to life is expressly qualified in those constitutions by the state's entitlement to impose the death penalty in certain cases. But that's where we can make the progress. You can say, okay, you can have the death penalty in some abstract theoretical case, but not in this case. And you can gradually erode the cases in which it's legitimate to impose it. So as defence lawyers, we can hope to progressively restrict the imposition of the death penalty through the judicial process, but we will not achieve its outright abolition through the judicial process. And that's broadly the position in international law, where the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights recognises the death penalty as a potentially legitimate punishment, but says that it should be reserved for the most serious of cases, whatever that means. So the process legally is going to be towards progressive restriction and progressive development of more and more exacting safeguards, leading to, hopefully, what is effectively a de facto abolition. Now, those judicial decisions of the Privy Council over the last two decades have been politically controversial. And Caribbean politicians, particularly at times nearing election or when there's been some particularly appalling crime or series of crimes, have criticised and denounced the Privy Council for imposing Eurocentric values in the death penalty decisions. I've heard most eloquent speeches about it's our right to kill if we choose to. It's not for the Privy Council to interfere. Two states, Bahamas and Belize, have now replaced appeals to the Privy Council by appeals to the newly created Caribbean Court of Justice, a local court. Now, the Caribbean Court of Justice was intended to be more local and more sensitive to criminal justice concerns of the local populations in the West Indies. Some mistakenly thought that it would prove more pro-death penalty, but in the Barbadian appeal of Boyce and Joseph, the Caribbean Court of Justice, which is comprised of distinguished Caribbean judges and one external judge, actually reaffirmed the correctness of the Privy Council's decisions, for example, on you can't be executed after long delay, and even went further in some respects. And the other point is that regional courts, such as the Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal, which is the second down, as it were, Privy Council top, Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal for the Eastern Caribbean, and then the High Court, itself has taken some very progressive initiatives, and it was the Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal that by a majority first declared that the mandatory death penalty was unconstitutional and refused to follow earlier Privy Council decisions. So in truth, the Privy Council's new approach and its landmark decisions in Pratt and Morgan, Neville Lewis, Rays are not eccentric, they're not Eurocentric, and they're not neo-colonialist. They're part of an international development in the judicial protection of human rights. So that's my second excuse for talking on this subject. Thirdly, the Privy Council's decisions have had a wider impact outside the Caribbean in other independent Commonwealth jurisdictions throughout Africa and Asia. And that's because the post-independence constitutions in Africa and the Asian Commonwealth countries have similarly worded provisions protecting the right to life and prohibiting inhuman punishments. And these countries had inherited a similar death penalty regime, the mandatory death penalty for murder, the reliance on the mercy system, the process of death by hanging, etc. So once the Privy Council adopted its new interpretative approach, for instance, by prohibiting the mandatory or automatic imposition of the death penalty on all those convicted of murder, it had repercussions beyond the Caribbean. It liberated the courts in those countries too from the former hands-off approach. So just to give you some examples, in the last 5 years, constitutional courts in Kenya, in Uganda and Malawi have willingly adopted the new interventionist approach to the application of the death penalty. For instance, the Ugandan Supreme Court in the case of Kugula said that execution after delay of 3 years from the completion of the judicial process was unconstitutional, and they struck down the mandatory imposition of the death penalty for all offences of murder or robbery, and said that from now on there had to be a sentencing hearing, there had to be a discretion which considered the individual circumstance of the offender. And in doing so, they expressly followed the Privy Council jurisprudence and that of the Indian Supreme Court and the US Supreme Court. So that's an example of, as it were, the universalization of these principles and the positive influence the Privy Council's recent decisions have had in the world, the wider world. And I had the experience of going on death row in Uganda, where 400 people were on death row, all affected by that decision. Many of them were, of course, political prisoners sentenced to death. Some were people who'd been sentenced to death for desertion or military offences. One of them was a 15-year-old boy with a Donald Duck T-shirt. All sentenced to death, but all affected by these new decisions. By contrast, there are other jurisdictions like Singapore, Malaysia, and most recently Ghana that have rejected the Privy Council's new approach as a deviation from the proper role of the courts and from its own earlier decisions. In Singapore, there's a 19-year-old Malaysian youth named Yong Vui Kong who now faces imminent execution. Both his appeals have been turned down. And he received the mandatory sentence of death automatically imposed in Singapore on all those convicted of possession of more than 15 grams of heroin. So it doesn't matter that you're a courier, it doesn't matter that you're poor, it doesn't matter that you've been put upon. If you're in possession of more than 15 grams of heroin, then you're presumed to be a drug trafficker and you are sentenced to death. And it's very, very rare that mercy is granted. His challenge to the constitutionality of the mandatory imposition of the death penalty relied heavily on the reasoning of the Privy Council in the Belizean appeal case of Rays, as well as decisions from the Indian and United States Supreme Court. But the Singapore Court of Appeal declined to follow these cases and declined to follow this emerging consensus that there must be some discretion on the imposition of the death penalty. It went back to the reasoning of the earlier Privy Council decision in a case called Ong Ah Chuan, a pretty dire decision of the Privy Council in 1981. And it relied on the reasoning of Lord Diplock. Let me just tell you something about that reasoning of Lord Diplock. The challenge was relying on US Supreme Court cases, Woodson and North Carolina, and Indian Supreme Court cases, Bakan Singh, you cannot have the mandatory imposition of the death penalty simply because someone is convicted of a category of offence. You've got to look at the individual circumstances of the case. You've got to look at the circumstances of the offender and of the offence. Lord Diplock said there's nothing wrong with the mandatory imposition of a death sentence. Firstly, because the death sentence was always mandatory at common law, which is slightly against any notion of the evolution of human rights principles. And secondly, because we have mandatory sentences for driving offences. This doesn't seem to be a very good point. The US Supreme Court cases all stress, the death penalty is special. It's not like any other penalty. You can't reason from what you do with some trivial offence to, well, it's okay for the death penalty. But what I think this shows is that the Singapore Court of Appeal is going back to the bad old decisions of the Privy Council in Ong Ah Chuan and the even worse decision in Run Yeoa. It is that the earlier, harsher Privy Council decisions still haunt us in constitutional challenges to the death penalty. And it's possible for the Singapore Court of Appeal to say, these decisions, these recent decisions, are just deviations of the progressive Binghamite court. Let's go back to the real jurisprudence of the Privy Council, and Lord Diplock on automatic sentences are okay. So I'd just like to do three things. Firstly, look at the colonial death penalty regime and its defects, then the constitutional savings clauses and the earlier decisions of the Privy Council, and finally the recent decisions. I hope that just to run through those. Now, I want to give four aspects of the colonial death penalty regime. This is part two, if you want to follow it in the text. But firstly, 2.2, firstly, death by hanging. That all our colonies were given that method of execution, death by hanging. It's a medieval, degrading, and unnecessarily painful method of execution. Don't believe what executioner Pierpont says in his autobiography about how death was swift, etc. Naismith and Jones exhumed the bodies of those who were executed and proved that only in one third of cases did they die by the severing of the vertebrae. In the other two thirds of cases, in other words, they were strangled to death. So it's not the pleasant, swift death that we're taught to believe, particularly when, as usually happens, it's carried out by inexpert executioners. Despite that, and despite all the evidence that was put forward from pathologists, in the Privy Council's cases of Boudram and Baptiste, the Privy Council said, we can't do anything about it. That is saved. Hanging is the only method of execution, and it's saved by the principles in the constitutions which say any description of punishment that was lawful in colonial times remains lawful for all times and cannot be constitutionally challenged. So except for in Belize, where there is no savings clause, throughout the Commonwealth Caribbean, you simply can't argue that why not have a more humane method of execution now that we've moved on. And that's despite the principle of international human rights law that any method of execution should involve only such pain and degradation as is absolutely necessary to actually extinguish life. That's the decision in Ung in Canada. Secondly, the colonial death penalty system provided the death penalty as the mandatory penalty for all those convicted of murder, irrespective of the particular nature of their offence and their individual mitigating circumstances. And that obviously was an aspect of the death penalty regime, which by the 1960s and 1970s no longer accorded with international human rights principles. The principle must be that you have individual mitigation considered before you impose the greatest of all penalties. After all, you have mitigation before a shoplifter is sent to prison. How can it possibly be right to not have no mitigation before someone convicted of murder, maybe on the basis of joint enterprise, is sentenced to death? And that was recognised by the US Supreme Court in Woodson. It's been recognised in a series of Indian Supreme Court cases. But in the earlier cases, which I've set out at 2.4, Run Yeoa and Ong Ah Chuan, the Privy Council said, there's nothing we can do about that. That's a matter for the legislature, not for the courts. And in Run Yeoa, they said it's saved by what's called the colonial savings clauses. I'll come on to those. And then the third aspect of the colonial death penalty system is, of course, the one that we still have with our life sentence, mandatory life sentence. The definition of murder is a very wide one. It includes, of course, anybody who is convicted of causing death with an intention to cause death or grievous bodily harm, so you don't even need an intention to kill. It extends to joint enterprise, and the available defences are relatively narrow given what's at stake. Limited defence of provocation, no excuse based on drunkenness, no defence of duress, and only a limited at common law insanity defence. So as a result, in the Caribbean jurisdictions, throughout the period up until the Reyes decisions, people were still being sentenced to death for domestic killings, for killings on the basis of joint enterprise, for killings where they just missed a provocation, for killings where they obviously had something wrong with them, but either the jurisdiction didn't have a diminished responsibility defence or they just didn't have the medical evidence to support it. And in all cases, the same extreme penalty of death was imposed. And that had obviously ceased to accord with international norms. And that led, eventually, to the trilogy of cases in Reyes, Hughes and Fox, which I'll briefly summarise. And then finally, and this I think is something which we're still, as it were, struggling with the inheritance of, the notion under the old system, which we had and which our colonies had, was you impose the mandatory sentence of death, now life imprisonment, for murder, and you leave it, in those days, to the executive to do justice in the individual case. And, of course, in the death penalty cases, that meant you left it to the governor in the colonies, sometimes on the advice of a mercy committee, to decide whether the death penalty should actually be carried out or not. And after the attainment of independence, that prerogative of mercy was passed on to the governor general in those states which kept the monarch as head of state, and to the president in Trinidad and in Guyana. But that was on the advice of advisory committees. But the vice of that is it's secretive. You don't see the reports on you that go to the Mercy Committee. It's the executive that's taking the decision rather than the judiciary. And the presumption is that the death penalty is right, but you've got to find some special reason for not applying it rather than having a judicial determination as to whether it should be imposed at all. Now, that reliance on an unreviewable mercy system as the means to do justice in the individual case is obviously objectionable because it gives a judicial function to the executive. And secondly, because it denied the condemned man any of the proper procedural safeguards of a sentencing hearing. You'll recall from our own experience, the Bentley case, Derek Bentley, was sentenced to death. And everybody thought, well, the Home Secretary will exercise the prerogative of mercy in this case. The report that was sent to the Home Secretary by Lord Goddard denounced Derek Bentley in very strong and inaccurate terms and said there was absolutely no grounds of mitigation, although there was clear evidence that he had mental problems, and also went into a great rant about the knuckle duster in the case. I remember when Lord Bingham saw it in the final appeal, he said, well, once one sees it, one wouldn't go into that kind of rant about this appalling instrument of death, as it were. Which, of course, was not used in any way in the killing. But that is an example of how a secret, unseen report can actually make the determine whether you die in a system which relies on executive clemency rather than on a judicial hearing before the death penalty is imposed. And so all the key features of the colonial system were really open to criticism. That's to say, the mandatory nature of the death sentence, the denial of natural justice at the mercy stage, and of course the insistence on death by hanging. But there was little that could be done because, firstly, the Privy Council took a very restrictive approach to its constitutional role, and secondly, because of colonial savings clauses. Can I just say a couple of just two final points about the colonial system. There were certain benefits of it, and they are these. Firstly, the death penalty was imposed very swiftly. That's to say, you didn't have these long periods of waiting on death row, which you have in other jurisdictions, well, you have now in the independent states, and indeed you have in the United States. It was regarded as absolutely inhuman to keep someone waiting for as long as 18 months. And there was a big fuss where Winston Churchill denounced it in a Gold Coast case in 1947, saying this is appalling to keep these people waiting while their appeals are exhausted. These things must... Secondly, there was a recognised right to some 72 hours notice before execution. Now, since independence in some states, there's a lot of political manoeuvring to execute people swiftly before they can access appellate rights. There was one case in Belize where they tried to execute in August when the Privy Council was on holiday and to make sure that, as it were, there couldn't be any access to appeal rights. In fact, luckily, in that case, the Privy Council, as it were, came off holiday heard a motion, a swift notice. And now it's been established in a case called Guerra and Baptiste that there must be, as there were in colonial times, at least 72 hours' notice so that the person can access his lawyers and make his peace with God before execution. Finally, the final thing I say about the colonial system is that the mercy system actually, in many of the jurisdictions, was relatively benign. And, for example, in Belize, we checked the statistics, and before independence, mercy was being granted in probably the majority of cases. So flawed as the system was, and arbitrary as it was in many ways, it did result in a lot of people being spared the death penalty. After independence, in many of the states, for political reasons, there became almost a policy of not granting mercy in any case. In Singapore, for example, I think they've only granted mercy in two cases. And there's a massive rate of execution for drug traffickers, including this poor 19-year-old boy who's now facing the death penalty unless mercy is granted. Now, the savings clauses I've got at part three, general savings clauses and partial savings clauses. Can I just summarise in this way? A general savings clause says any law that there was in colonial times will remain constitutional for all time. You simply can't attack it. So if it's in colonial times it said the death penalty is for murder, there will be death penalty for murder, you simply can't challenge that by constitutional challenge. You might be able to do it politically, but you can't constitutionally. It remains immune from constitutional challenge. And that's the position in Trinidad and in Barbados. Partial savings clauses, and you've got an example of that 3.2, page 16, I hope, are slightly more different. What they do is to immunise a description of punishment which was lawful immediately before independence from challenge. And the purpose of those most probably was to protect punishments such as corporal punishment and the death penalty itself from being attacked as inhuman in themselves. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can't argue that to impose the death penalty on all those convicted of murder is wrong or corporal punishment on particular offences is wrong. It just means you can't say you simply can't have any flogging or any hanging. And that's so what's been important has been the narrowing down by judicial committee decisions of the scope of that partial savings clause. But initially, the partial savings clauses caused massive problems to lawyers in even getting any challenges off the ground in the first place. Now, I've just summarised the progress over the last 15 years at part four. Firstly, early challenges to the constitutionality of death after delay were unsuccessful, but they've proved much more successful since the landmark decision of Pratt and Morgan. Secondly, early decisions, early challenges to the mercy stage were rejected. Lord Diplock said in the case of De Freitas and Benny, mercy begins where legal rights end, i.e. it doesn't matter what decision is taken, how unfair it is at the mercy stage, it's totally unreviewable by the courts. But that was reversed in a case called Neville Lewis. And finally, in the early days, they said you can't challenge the mandatory imposition of the death sentence, and that's Ranier and Ong Ah Chuan, and that all changed with the cases of Reyes, Hughes and Fox, finally, in 2002. Now, can I just deal with some of those cases just to give you a summary of them? Pratt and Morgan, you've got at part five. Pratt and Morgan had been on death row for 14 years. They'd been taken out for execution into the condemned cell three times and been spared at the last moment. And the Privy Council said that was cruel and inhuman. Execution after long delay was unconstitutional. But they had to get round an earlier case called Riley, where it was held by 3-2 that there was nothing wrong with execution after delay because execution itself was lawful, and no matter how long the delay, it didn't affect the legality of execution. And you've got that at 5.2, the summary of the Riley case. What the Privy Council did in that case was to say, firstly, the savings clause only saved the penalty that was imposed by the judge, that's to say death by hanging, from challenge. It didn't stop the courts from looking at what the executive did thereafter. So if the executive then delayed for many years to execute, the executive act of delaying was challengeable in constitutional proceedings. And you've got that at 5.4. And that executive delay could be challenged on grounds of inhumanity. And you'll see that they held that in pre-colonial, in colonial days, there would have been a ground to challenge execution after long delay. And if you look at 5.5, you've got what Lord Griffith said. There is an instinctive revulsion against the prospect of hanging a man after he was being held under sentence of death for many years. What gives rise to this instinctive revulsion? The answer can only be our humanity. We regard it as an inhuman act to keep a man facing the agony of execution over a long extended period of time. And in the end, the board ruled that execution after 5 years on death row, even if it was a period of time consumed in appeals initiated by the defendant, was inhuman and degrading. You've got to have a swift system of dealing with appeals. In doing so, the board rejected the formalistic approach in Riley, and it followed cases of the European Court in Söhring and the Inter-American Court in a case called, in the case of Pratt itself. So that's the first thing. So delay. Now, that's had a massive, massive effect. I mean, some people would parody what happens now as that defence lawyers simply try to keep things going for as long as possible, because once you're over the five-year mark, the person can't be executed. Again, that the states themselves try and speed everything up push the appeals through as fast as possible, the hearings through as fast as possible. The Pratt and Morgan case has had a massive effect, and it was said to be an aberration by the Privy Council, but when the Caribbean Court of Justice came to look at it, the local court that was substituted for Barbados, they upheld the Privy Council and indeed said execution after 2 years of delay was inhuman. Now, the next big case is Neville Lewis, and that involved the reviewability of the prerogative of mercy. The old idea was mercy is completely extrajudicial. You've been sentenced to death. Anything less than death is a present from the executive. So you can't review it at all. It's extrajudicial, it's extraordinary, it's derived from the monarchical prerogative of mercy, and the courts can't get involved. If you get mercy, good luck. If you don't, the courts aren't going to look at it. But mercy begins where legal rights end. Now, of course, that really ignored the reality that this was the true sentencing stage, because the judge could only say, I sentence you to death. Any consideration of individual merits had to be at the mercy stage. And in any event, it didn't work particularly well, because what happened in many cases after independence was, if you were powerful, or you had somebody powerful who had access to the executive on your behalf, you might well get mercy. If you were some pathetic individual who had nobody rooting on behalf of you, you would be executed. And the famous case of Mr. Shit in St. Kitts, who was a poor guy who was executed, who had been abandoned by his mother in a latrine as a youth, and as Aubrey calls in the orphanage, Mr. Shit, he was executed because there was nobody there rooting for him. There was nobody to speak up for him. After his execution, the press had lots of articles saying, how could we have executed this person? The answer is because you've got a secretive process after the mandatory sentence where politicians decide whether the death penalty is imposed. And there are factors like, is there an election coming up? Do we want to make a statement about getting tough on crime, et cetera, are going to be more influenced than the individual merits of the case. So the case of Neville Lewis was really important because it reversed the approach in De Freitas and Benny, we're not going to get involved. And they said that they refused to follow two earlier cases, De Freitas and Reckley, saying if we got it wrong twice, it's time we got it right, as it were, rather than let's stick by stare decisis. And you'll see that set out at 6.3. And then they held that the Mercy decision was reviewable, and they held at 6.5, I've set it out, that the principles of natural justice did apply. That's to say, you had to be able to see the reports from the trial judge that were written about you and be able to comment on them. And they said that what really determines whether you're entitled to see the reports on you is not saying, well, this is a special type of decision. It's derived from the monarchical prerogative. It's taken by distinguished people, etc. You don't look at the formal nature of the decision. You look at the magnitude of what's at stake, and you look at the capacity for error if there isn't full disclosure. And that's what's set out at 6.5. And that's really in keeping with modern administrative law principles, that the prerogative should be reviewable. Now, in the case of Yong Vui Kong, which I've dealt with at 6.6, they didn't follow that in Singapore. And in Singapore, in the case of Yong Vui Kong, the 19-year-old boy I've referred to, he lost his first appeal against the mandatory sentence. And then he challenged, most recently, just months ago, the Mercy decision. And that was on the basis that one of the ministers who was going to be involved in taking the decision had said, we can't grant mercy in cases like this, or it will send out the wrong signal. And naturally, the defendant could say, well, hey, hang on, I don't want this guy taking a decision. He's made a public statement indicating what his decision is going to be at the end. On basic principles of bias, he shouldn't be there. And they said, no, that doesn't, those kind of principles don't apply. Back to Lord Diplock, legal rights end and mercy begins. There is no judicial reviewability there. And that shows that the Singapore Court of Appeal and indeed the Malaysian Court of Appeal are refusing to follow the recent decisions and going back to the old decisions, which enshrined an unfair and secretive system without proper judicial review. I've dealt at Part 7 with the case of Neville, another aspect of the case of Neville Lewis. There was a right of appeal to international bodies. The question was, can they execute you while your appeal is pending before an Inter-American Commission or the Inter-American Court? Now, on strict legal principles, because the right to appeal to an international court is part of international law, which isn't domestic law, you actually have no right to conclude your appeal. And that's the Tin Council case, etc. So international law doesn't affect domestic law. But in a case called Guerin Baptiste, the Privy Council got round that by saying, this isn't about incorporating international law into domestic law. It's about the right accorded to all litigants not to have the outcome of any pending appellate or other legal process preempted by executive action. And they said that this general right is not created by the convention. It is accorded by the common law and affirmed by Section 4A of the Constitution. I can't go into that in great detail now, but it's an extremely explosive concept, because you think of that when you've got someone being extradited or deported when they've got a case pending before the European Court. And you could argue the same principle, that the right not to have your appeal, the result of your appeal, preempted by executive action. So I think it's a... But whenever we've sought to apply that principle in that context, it's been said, well, it's different because the death penalty cases are special. But that was a very important decision that you are entitled, it may seem very obvious, but it wasn't so straightforward legally, that you're entitled to conclude your hearing before the Inter-American Commissional Court before you're executed. Now, I just want to deal with two final cases because I know I'm running out of time. If you look at these cases so far, and again the case of Guerra, what they've all were about was executive action. That's to say, executive delay in execution, executive executing you while you've still got an appeal pending, executive unfairness in the way in which mercy is considered. And so they were nibbling at the edges of the system, but they weren't confronting the real question: should you have the mandatory death penalty for murder at all? Is it right to have a mandatory death penalty for murder at all? And it was regarded as saved by the savings clauses. But in Belize, there was no savings clause. And so it was possible to challenge it outright. And you'll see at part 9, the Privy Council decision there, they refused to follow the earlier cases of Ong Ah Chuan and Ranyoa. And they followed instead a decision of the Eastern Caribbean Court, which had said that we've got to evolve our standards of what is right. We've got to look at what the Indian Supreme Court says. We've got to look at what the US Supreme Court says. And we've got to, as it were, develop more sophisticated principles of constitutional challenge than Lord Diplock in Ong Ah Chuan. And Lord Bingham, you'll see, he set out 9.1, where he says murder covers a wide variety of different levels of turpitude. And the underlying passage, in a crime of this kind, there well may be matters relating both to the offence and the offender which ought properly to be considered before sentence is passed. To deny the offender the opportunity before sentence is passed to seek to persuade the court that in all the circumstances to condemn him to death would be disproportionate and inappropriate is to treat him as no human being should be treated, and thus to deny his basic humanity, the core of the right which Section 7 exists to protect. So that, again, the appeal to basic principles of humanity, as in the Pratt and Morgan case, and then saying it's not good enough to do it through the mercy system. It's got to be done by judges before the death penalty is imposed, not by the executive after the death penalty is imposed. That was a key breakthrough. Now, I won't go into the details. Having got that decision in Reyes, in Belize, how the Privy Council then dealt with the savings clauses in the Eastern Caribbean, but it's set out at parts 10, 11, and 12. And basically what they said was, all that's saved by the partial savings clauses is you can't say hanging is cruel, but you can say the penalty of hanging as the mandatory penalty for murder is cruel because it's disproportionate. Now, it's quite a subtle point, and it involved Lord Roger, who gave the judgment, actually reversing the approach taken in Pratt and Morgan, but it did change things throughout the Eastern Caribbean. And the result of that is, firstly, as I said, the inspiration to other jurisdictions in Africa, Kenya, Malawi, Uganda, all those jurisdictions have followed the Reyes decision. But then the question arose, you've got to have a new sentencing system. You've got to have discretion in the sentences. And so the judges, originally the question was, should juries or judges do it? And the Privy Council said it should be judges who decide whether the death penalty is imposed. Well, the judges in the Eastern Caribbean weren't that enthusiastic about having to take that decision themselves. But then the question is, well, if you've got a discretionary death penalty, what are the principles that apply? How do you decide who lives and who dies? And there were really, consistent with having some discretion, you could have three different approaches. You could have a presumption in favour of the death penalty, i.e. that's the normal cause, with exceptions. You can make out extenuating circumstances, rather like the driving offences, if I can give the analogy, special circumstances. Or you could have a discretion at large, which is what, of course, they have to some extent in the US cases. You balance aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Or you could have a principle where you have a presumption in favour of imposing a life sentence with the death penalty reserved for the exceptional and gravest of the grave cases. And that's the approach which was adopted in India by the Indian Supreme Court. Presumption in favour of life sentence. Death penalty only in the most extreme cases. And it's the principle that was adopted first by the Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal and then by the Privy Council. Now, there was a second principle which we managed to derive from the cases in the South African courts before the abolition of the death penalty there, of course, in South Africa by constitutional challenge because there were no savings clauses under the new constitution. In the case of Makwinyana, the Constitutional Court outlawed the death penalty as inconsistent with the right to life. But before abolition, the South African courts had developed a principle that you shouldn't be executed unless you are beyond all hope of reformation, which is a pretty exacting standard, and in a case called Nakwinyana. Now, we married those two principles in the cases in the Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal, and the Eastern Caribbean Court of Appeal accepted those two standards. So if you look at page 42, you'll see the case of Trimmingham, where Lord Carswell says that the judges in the Caribbean courts have in the past few years set out the approach which a sentencing judge should follow in a case where the imposition of the death sentence is discretionary. This approach received the approval of the board in Piepersburg. It can be expressed in two basic principles. The first has been expressed in several different formulations, but they all carry the same message. The death penalty should be imposed only in cases which are the worst of the worst, the rarest of the rare. Now, that's the Indian Supreme Court. In considering whether a particular case falls, the judge should, of course, compare it with other murder cases and not with ordinary civilised behaviour. The second principle is that there must be no reasonable prospect of reform of the offender. The object of punishment could not be achieved by any other means than the ultimate sentence of death. And then they said this was a pretty appalling case, Trimmingham. They said, bad as it was, it wasn't the rarest of the rare. It was gruesome and violent, but there was no torture of the deceased, no prolonged trauma or humiliation prior to death. And then at paragraph 23 of the judgment, they said that it falls short of the worst of the worst. And their lordships would also point out that the object of keeping the appellant out of society entirely, which the judge considered necessary, can be achieved without executing him. Now, the result of all that is, of course, that it is really only in the rarest cases that the death penalty continues to be imposed in Belize, in the Eastern Caribbean, in Bahamas, and in Jamaica. And that's the Privy Council from Runioa, where they say we're not going to get involved at all, to Trimmingham is a massive journey in the space of a few decades towards extreme judicial intervention in restricting the death penalty but not abolishing it. Now, I've just set out finally that you can't, so far as I can see, mount a frontal constitutional challenge to the death penalty because it's enshrined as a legitimate form of punishment in all the constitutions and recognised as a legitimate form of punishment under international law by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So if there is abolition, it will probably come through political purposes. But I would just make one point, is that once you drag this process out from the secretive mercy situation, which condemned poor Mr. Shit and Derek Bentley to death, and you have instead a hearing in open court in which mitigation can be heard, then some crimes which appear unspeakable, once you hear the full circumstances of the offender, one can see grounds for saying it's not the worst of the worst. He is not beyond hope of reformation. And that actually can help to dramatise and demonstrate that the death penalty simply is not justified. The Reyes case was a great example of that. Reyes was sentenced to death. The jury rejected diminished responsibility. He had shot two neighbours and wounded two others in the course of a neighbour dispute. When the Privy Council said there's got to be a discretion and ordered a resentencing, evidence came out that he clearly was very seriously mentally disordered, which had been missed in the original trial and appeal process. But moreover, even one of his victims, one of the people who was attempted murder, came and gave evidence on his behalf, saying, I know it was an aberration. I know this person shouldn't die. And there was massive evidence from people in his community, pastors, everything, saying this was a rare aberration. There must have been something wrong with him at the time. Now, if you'd had the old mandatory system with an unreviewable mercy system, Reyes might well have been executed. But once you had an open court hearing in which witnesses could come forward and everything could be fully examined, the judge clearly said, well, I'm not going to impose the death penalty, I'll impose life sentence instead. And so I think bringing these things out of the secretive mercy process to a judicial hearing in which the rights and wrongs of the death penalty are debated openly in an individual case does serve, well, it's obviously the fairest and justest system, but it also may be part of a process whereby people move towards a recognition that the death penalty is actually wrong. And so I think it can be part of, although it won't be the only process towards the eventual abolition of the death penalty. Now, I'll leave everything else for any questions. I've tried to race through it a bit, and some of the bits I'm afraid I haven't dealt with in great detail. But if for those who are interested, I just put my own, as it were, six best points against the death penalty at the end, in case anybody, obviously in the light of Bin Laden and all that, the question of the death penalty looms large. But it's just to, as it were, rehearse what the reasons are why one should have the death penalty. But as I say, we as lawyers defending people on death row in Commonwealth countries, with the only exception is South Africa, where it's been abolished, obviously, by the Constitutional Court because there were no savings clauses and the right to life was not qualified by save where the person is executed following conviction before a competent court. But it will be a restrictionist rather than an abolitionist task for lawyers representing those on death row. Well, I think that's really all I've got to say. So what I'm basically saying is the Privy Council has participated in a process whereby international human rights law is developing towards the restriction of the death penalty to the most extreme cases, the insistence on the utmost procedural fairness, and the moving away from the notion that once you're sentenced to death, you have no rights, insisting that due process goes on right, as it were, to the moment of the scaffold. And in that, the Privy Council really has played an incredibly important role. It's a bit of a... There really isn't... You won't find it anywhere. There's not much sort of literature on it, on the Privy Council. Obviously Lord Bingham, recently deceased, played an incredibly important part in that process with other law lords such as Lord Rogers, Lord Steyne, who also gave some of the leading judgments. I think it is something of which we can be proud of the Privy Council, that what they have done from the bad old decisions of Lord Diplock, where he was part of the problem, to the decisions of the recent Privy Council courts, where they've really introduced a solution and made the death penalty a far rarer event in the Caribbean, and influenced other courts throughout the world to change their attitudes. I think it is actually quite an inspiring story what particularly the Lord Bingham Court did. To change things in the cases I've set out here, and so if there are any questions, I'm as it were.
Thank you very much.